There is no threat here. I'm standing out in the open, put it down. Bosch wondered if Sisto and Trevino had heard any of the confrontation, and what action they might be taking. He looked down the side of the house in the direction of the backyard and saw no one. If they were coming, they were doing so on the other side of the house. It was a good move, giving them two angles on the man with a gun. He turned back around and edged closer to the corner. Valdez was now almost 20 feet out from the house and halfway to the street. He still had his hands held up, and in the flashlight beam, Bosch was reminded by the smooth fit of his black polo shirt that the chief was not wearing a ballistic vest underneath. It was a detail that would factor into the decisions Harry was about to make. He knew he might have to engage first to prevent Dockweiler from taking a shot at Valdez. "Why are you here, Chief?" Dockweiler demanded. "I told you," Valdez said calmly. "Looking for Bella." "Who sent you here? Was it that guy Bosch?" "What makes you bring him up?" Before Dockweiler could respond, there was a chorus of shouts from the front yard, and Bosch recognized the voices of Trevino and Sisto. "Put the gun down! Dockweiler, put the gun down!" Bosch moved forward and out from the side of the house. Dockweiler had swung the flashlight and the aim of his gun to the other side, where Trevino and Sisto were side by side in combat firing stances. Bosch realized he had the drop on Dockweiler, who was so preoccupied by the other three men in the yard that he was not expecting a fourth. Bosch covered the ground to the back of the pickup truck in less than 3 seconds. Valdez saw Bosch, and he knew he needed to move the aim of Dockweiler's weapon off the other two men before the impact from Bosch. "Kurt, right here!" he yelled. Dockweiler started to swing the light back toward the police chief, the muzzle of his handgun moving with it. Bosch hit him with his upper body, smashing his chest into Dockweiler's left arm and upper torso. Dockweiler made an oof sound as the air blasted out of his lungs, and he fell heavily to the ground. Bosch bounced off the bigger man and went the opposite way to the ground. No shot was fired. Sisto moved in and jumped on Dockweiler before he could recover from the impact. He grabbed his gun hand with two hands and wrested it free, then threw it onto the lawn a safe distance away. Valdez soon followed on the pile, and Dockweiler, a larger man than any of the other four, was controlled. Bosch crawled over and put his weight on the back of the man's legs while Trevino moved in and pulled his arms behind his back for cuffing. "What the fuck is this?" Dockweiler yelled. "Where is she?" Valdez yelled right back. "Where is Bella?" "I don't know what you're talking about," Dockweiler managed to say, despite Sisto pushing his face into the grass of his front lawn. "I haven't seen or talked to that bitch in 2 years." Valdez backed off the pile and stood up. "Get him up," he ordered. "We'll get him inside, see if he's got the keys on him." The flashlight had fallen to the grass and was pointing away from the men. Bosch reached over and grabbed it and started sweeping it over the grass, looking for the gun. When he spotted it, he got up and went to claim it. Dockweiler took the opportunity to attempt one last effort at standing up. Trevino drove a knee into the side of his torso, and the impact ended the move. Dockweiler stopped resisting. "Okay, okay," he said, "I give up. You assholes, what is it? 4 against 1? Fuck you." Trevino and Sisto started checking his pockets for keys. "No, fuck you, Dockweiler," Sisto said. "Tell us where Bella is. We know you grabbed her." "You are out of your fucking minds," Dockweiler responded. Bosch put the light on the truck's open tailgate. He moved so that he could angle the light into the camper shell, fearful of what he might see. But there was only an assortment of tools in the back of the truck, and it was not readily apparent to him what Dockweiler had been doing at the tailgate when they watched him from the corner of the house. Bosch noticed the key ring sitting on the tailgate and grabbed it. "I have the keys," he reported to the others. While Sisto and Trevino stood Dockweiler up, Valdez came over to get a look at the back of the pickup. "This didn't exactly go down textbook," Bosch said. "How do you want to handle it from here? No warrant, he's not going to be inviting us in." "No PC, but plenty of EC if you ask me," Valdez said. "We need to get into the house. Let's open it." Bosch agreed, but it was always better when the police chief himself made the call. Probable cause and a judge's signature were needed for a search warrant, but exigent circumstances trumped all. There was no definitive legal definition that perfectly outlined the bounds of which emergencies allowed for the relaxing of constitutional protections. But Bosch felt that a missing police officer and a gun-wielding former colleague would qualify in any court in the land. He checked the open garage as he walked to the front door. It was stacked full with boxes and pallets. There was no room to park the truck in there, so he wondered why Dockweiler had opened the door. When he got to the front door, he put the light on the key ring. There were several keys, including one Bosch recognized as the universal key that started all police and city vehicles, as well as a small bronze key that would open a smaller lock. He reached into his pocket and brought out his own keys. He compared the small bronze key to the filing cabinet in his cubicle at the detective bureau to the one on Dockweiler's ring. The teeth lined up exactly. Bosch had no doubt now. Dockweiler had kept a key to his desk in the detective bureau after transferring to Public Works, and was the one who had clandestinely been checking the screen cutter file. Bosch opened the front door with the second key he tried, and then held the door as Dockweiler was walked in by Sisto and Trevino. Valdez was the last to enter. Bosch was holding up Dockweiler's key ring by the file key. "What's that?" Valdez asked. "The key to my file drawer and his ring," Bosch said. "I figured out last week that somebody was reviewing my files, especially on the screen cutter. I thought it was someone in the bureau, but it was him." Valdez nodded. It was another detail falling into place. "Where do we put him?" asked Sisto. "In the kitchen if there's a table and chairs," Trevino said. "Lock him to a chair." Bosch followed the chief down the entrance hall and to the left into the kitchen and watched as Sisto and Trevino use two pairs of cuffs to secure Dockweiler to a chair in front of a cluttered table in a small dining nook that was the glass add-on Bosch had noticed from the backyard. It had floor-to-ceiling windows on three sides with Venetian blinds to help control the heat the sun generated on the glass. Bosch wondered if Dockweiler had considered that when he added the atrium room to his house. "This is bullshit," the former detective said as soon as he was secured to the chair. "You got no warrant, you got no case, you come busting in here, this won't stand, this will go down in flames, and then I'll own all of you assholes, and the city of San Fernando." Dockweiler's face was dirty from the struggle on the front lawn, but in the harsh fluorescent light from the kitchen ceiling fixture, Bosch could see slight discoloration in the corners of his eyes and an unnatural thickness in the upper nose, residual bruising and swelling from a significant impact. He could also see that Dockweiler had tried to hide the purplish-yellow bruising with makeup. The kitchen table had been set up as a bill-paying station. There were credit card invoices and two checkbooks stacked sloppily on the left. On the right were pay stubs, financial records, and unopened mail in piles. At the center was a coffee mug filled with pens and pencils, and an ashtray overflowing with cigarette butts. The house had the distinct smell of a smoker's home. Bosch picked it up with every breath. Bosch went to the window over the kitchen sink and unlocked it and opened it to let some fresh air in. He then went to the table. He moved the mug to the left side of the table because he wanted nothing between himself and Dockweiler when they talked. He started to pull out the chair directly across the table from him. He knew that there were two things at stake in the interrogation that was about to begin: Bella Lourdes and the screen cutter case. Bosch was about to sit down when Trevino stopped him. "Hold on, hold on." He pointed toward the hallway. "Chief, let's step out and talk for a minute," Trevino said. "Bosch, you too. Sisto, you stay with him." "Yeah, you guys go out and talk about it," Dockweiler mocked. "Try to figure out how you fuck this whole thing up and how you're going to unfuck it." Bosch turned at the archway that led from the kitchen into the hallway. He looked at Dockweiler, then at Sisto. He nodded. Whatever their differences, Sisto and Trevino had played it right when they had come up the side of the house. The chief might be a dead man if they hadn't. Sisto nodded back. Trevino led the way down the hallway to the front door. Bosch and Valdez followed. They spoke in low voices, and Trevino got right to the point. "I'm going to handle the interview," Trevino said. Bosch looked from Trevino to Valdez and waited a moment for the chief to speak against that idea. But Valdez said nothing. Bosch looked back at Trevino. "Wait a minute," he said. "It's my case. I know it better than anybody. I should do the interview." "The priority here is Bella," Trevino said, "not the case. And I know her better than you." Bosch shook his head like he didn't get it. "That makes no sense," he said. "It doesn't matter how well you know her. It's how well you know the case. He's the screen cutter. He grabbed Bella because she got too close on the case, or figured it out when she was with him. Let me talk to him. We don't know he's the screen cutter for sure yet, Trevino said. We need to first... Did you see his eyes? Bosch said, interrupting. Swollen and purple from where Beatrice Sahagun hit him with a stick. He tried to cover it with makeup. There's no doubt. He's the screen cutter. You may not know it, but I do. Bosch again turned to Valdez on appeal. Chief, I've got to do this, he said. Harry, the chief said, the captain and I talked about this before any of this with Bella even came up. It's about what could happen down the line, you know, in court, with your history. My history, Bosch asked? Really? You mean the 100-plus murders I've cleared? That history? You know what he means, Trevino said. Your controversies. They make you a target in court. They undercut you. We also have the reserve issue, Valdez added. You're not full-time, and that's something that a lawyer will pick apart in court. It won't look good in front of a jury. I probably put in as many hours a week as Sisto does, Bosch said. Doesn't matter, Trevino said. You're a reserve. It is what it is. I'm going to do this interview, and I want you to go through the house and look for any signs of Bella, any evidence at all that he had her here. And when you're finished with that, go search the truck. For a third time, Bosch looked at Valdez, and it was clear he was siding with Trevino on this. Just do it, Harry, he said. Do it for Bella, okay? Yeah, sure thing, Bosch said. For Bella. Call me when you need me. Trevino turned and started back toward the kitchen. Valdez lingered a bit and just nodded to Bosch before following his captain. Bosch was supremely frustrated at being pulled away from his own case, but not interested in putting his professional pride and emotions above the ultimate goal, especially with Bella Lourdes unaccounted for. He had no doubt he should be handling the interview, and had the better skills for drawing information from Dockweiler. But he also believed that he would eventually get the chance to use them. Captain, he said. Trevino turned around to look back at him. Don't forget to read him his rights, Bosch said. Of course, Trevino said. He then went through the archway into the kitchen. Chapter 31 Bosch moved into the living room, and then down a hallway leading to bedrooms. He knew he had to be very careful and put emotions aside here. He believed that the exigent circumstances of having an officer missing allowed him to search Dockweiler's house without legal risk. But searching for evidence in the screen cutter case was different. He would need a warrant for that. The contradiction put him in a legal predicament. He had to search the house for Lourdes and any indications or evidence of her location, but he couldn't dig deeper for evidence that Dockweiler committed the rapes. He had to be realistic, too. His newfound knowledge of Dockweiler and the fact that he had kept a key and had been secretly entering the police station to read the investigative file was convincing evidence that he was the screen cutter. With that conclusion in mind, it seemed unlikely to Bosch that they were going to find Bella alive, and possibly unlikely they would find her at all. He needed to put the screen cutter case first here, and preserve it against any future legal challenge. He put on a pair of latex gloves, and began the search by starting at the end of the bedroom hallway, and working his way back toward the kitchen. There were three bedrooms, but only one was used as such. He searched Dockweiler's room first, and found it to be a mess, with clothes and shoes strewn on the floor everywhere around the bed, most likely in the spots where they were shed. The bed was unmade, and the sheets had a dingy gray cast to them. The walls were yellowed, but not with paint. The room smelled sour with perspiration and cigarette smoke. Bosch kept a rubber-gloved hand over his mouth as he moved through it. The attached bath was just as unkempt, with more clothing thrown in the bathtub and a horribly stained toilet. Bosch picked a hanger up off the floor and fished around in the bathtub to make sure there wasn't anything or anyone hidden beneath the clothes. The clothes in the tub seemed dirty in a way separate from the clothes left on the floor of the bedroom. They were caked with a granular gray dust that Bosch believed might be concrete dust. He wondered if it was debris from an inspection or a public works project. The phone booth shower was empty, its white tiles as dingy as the bedroom sheets, and the drain had trapped more of the concrete powder and granules. He next moved into a small walk-in closet in the bathroom, and found it to be surprisingly neat, primarily because most of the items of clothing it would normally hold were on the bedroom floor and in the bathtub. The two other bedrooms were used for storage. The small room was lined with glass door gun cabinets, with several rifles and shotguns on display. Most had tags attached to the trigger guards that identified the ammunition they were presumably loaded with. The larger guest bedroom was used for storage of life-sustaining supplies. There were stacked pallets of bottled water and energy drinks, and boxes of canned and powdered goods that would presumably have distant expiration dates. The closets of both rooms were similarly stacked, and there was no sign of Bella in that side of the house. As Bosch worked his way through the bedroom wing, he could hear muffled voices from the kitchen. He could not make out words, but he could detect tones in individual voices. It was Trevino doing almost all of the talking. He wasn't getting anywhere with Dockweiler. In the hallway near the bedrooms, Bosch noticed an attic access door in the ceiling. There were fingerprint smears on the frame around it, but these offered no hint as to how long it had been since Dockweiler was up there. Bosch looked around and saw a 4-foot-long wooden dowel with a hook on the end of it leaning against the wall in the corner. Grabbing it and threading the hook through the metal eyelet on the attic door, he pulled it open and found it very similar to the attic entrance at Olivia McDonald's house. He folded the hinged ladder down and started to climb. Bosch found the pull string for an overhead light and soon was scanning the attic. The space was small, and more boxes of survivalist supplies were stacked to the roof rafters. He climbed all the way up so he could see around boxes and into every angle of the attic to make sure Bella Lourdes was not there. He then climbed back down, but left the attic open and the ladder unfolded so it could be accessed for a more thorough search with a warrant. When Bosch moved into the living room and dining area, he could clearly hear what was being said in the kitchen. Dockweiler was not cooperating, and Trevino had moved to a threatening form of interrogation that Bosch knew was rarely successful. "You're cooked, my friend," Trevino said. "It's a DNA case. As soon as we match yours to the evidence collected from the victims, it's over. You're over. You'll get consecutive sentences and never breathe free air again. The only way you can help yourself is to give us back Bella. Tell us where she is and we'll go to bat for you. With the DA, with the judge, you name it." Trevino's plea was met with silence. Everything the captain said was true, but delivering it as a threat would rarely get a suspect with a screen cutter's profile to cooperate and talk. Bosch knew that a proper interview would appeal to his narcissism, his genius. Harry would have attempted to make Dockweiler think he was controlling the interview and bleed information out of him, bit by bit. Bosch crossed through the living room and into the entrance hallway. He saw Valdez leaning against the wall next to the archway to the kitchen, watching the interview with Dockweiler go nowhere. He looked back at Bosch and raised his chin, asking if Harry had found anything. Bosch just shook his head. Just before the kitchen entrance, there was a door that led into the garage. Bosch entered, flicked on the overhead lights, and closed the door behind him. The space was also used for storage of survival supplies. More pallets of canned goods, water, and powdered mixes. Somehow Dockweiler had gotten a hold of a supply of U.S. Army-produced MREs, meals ready to eat. There were also non-edible supplies here. Boxes of batteries, lanterns, first aid kits, tool kits, CO2 scrubbers, water filters, and enzyme additives for water filtration and use in chemical toilets. There were boxes of light sticks and medical supplies such as betadine and potassium iodide. Bosch remembered those from his military training, when the threat of nuclear holocaust from the Soviet Union seemed real. Both chemicals acted as thyroid protection against cancer-causing radioactive iodine. It looked like Dockweiler was prepped for all possibilities, from terrorist attack to nuclear detonation. Bosch returned to the door and stuck his head back into the entrance hallway. He drew Valdez's attention and signaled him into the garage. As the police chief entered, his eyes held on the stacks of supplies in the center of the garage. "What is all this?" he asked. "Dockweiler's a survivalist," Bosch said. "Looks like he must put all his money into this stuff. The attic and two of the bedrooms are full of D-Day supplies and weapons. He's got an arsenal in one bedroom. And it looks like he could go 3 or 4 months with this stuff as long as he doesn't mind eating army beef stew out of a can. Well, I hope he packed a can opener. It might explain some of his motivation. When the world is coming to an end, people act out. Take what they want. Is Trevino getting anywhere?" No. Nowhere. Doc Weiler's just playing games, denying everything, then hinting he might know something. Bosch nodded. He assumed that he would get his shot as soon as he was finished with the search. I'm going to take a quick look at the truck and then call a judge. I want a legit warrant to really do a down-and-dirty search of this place. Valdez was smart enough to read Bosch's thinking. So you think Bella's gone, huh? Bosch hesitated, then nodded somberly. I mean, why would he keep her alive, he said. Our profiler said this guy was going to graduate to murder. Bella could ID him. Why let her live? Valdez dropped his chin to his chest. Sorry, Chief, Bosch said, just being realistic about things. I know, Valdez said, but we're not going to stop until we find her, one way or the other. I wouldn't want to. Valdez clapped him on the arm and went back through the door into the house. Bosch moved down a narrow passageway through the stacks to the driveway in Doc Weiler's truck. The front cab was unlocked, and he opened it on the passenger side, since it was most likely that side would show an indication if Bella Lourdes had been in the truck. On the passenger seat sat a large closed bag from a McDonald's restaurant. Bosch stripped off a glove and placed the back of his fingers against the bag. It was slightly warm to the touch, and Bosch assumed that Doc Weiler's arrival at the house had come after he went out to pick up dinner. Bosch put the glove back on and opened the bag. He still had the flashlight he'd collected off the front lawn. He pulled it from his back pocket and pointed the beam down into the bag. He counted two cardboard sandwich cartons and two large sleeves of French fries. Bosch knew that the contents of the bag could easily constitute dinner for one big man like Doc Weiler, but he also knew it was more likely dinner for two. For the first time since they had entered Doc Weiler's house, he was hit with the hope that Bella was alive. He pondered whether Doc Weiler was stopping by his house before taking the food to his captive someplace else, or whether she was here somewhere, and he just hadn't found her. He thought of the drainage wash down the slope behind Doc Weiler's house. Maybe she was down there. He left the food bag in place and used the flashlight beam to comb the dark carpet and sides of the passenger seat. He saw nothing that held his attention or indicated Bella had been in the truck. He kept the flashlight on and moved to the back of the pickup. He pointed the beam into the far corners of the truck's bed and camper shell. Again he saw nothing that connected to Lourdes or to the screen cutter. Still, Doc Weiler had been doing something at the tailgate when the chief's phone sounded the alarm. He had also opened the garage with a purpose other than parking his truck. Bosch still couldn't figure out what he had been up to. Stored in the back of the pickup was an upside-down wheelbarrow, a two-wheeled hand truck, and several long tools, three shovels, a hoe, a push broom, and a pick, as well as several drop cloths for keeping workspaces clean. The shovels were not duplicates. One had a pointed spade for digging, and the other two had straight edges of different widths, and Bosch knew these would be used for scooping up debris. Each of them was dirty. The pointed spade with a dark red soil and the straight-edged blades with the same gray concrete dust as in the bathtub. He put the light on the wheelbarrow's rubber wheel and saw large chunks of concrete caught in the tread. Doc Weiler had no doubt been involved in a recent project involving concrete, but Bosch held off concerns that he had buried Bella Lourdes. The clothes in the bathtub with the same debris as the tools accounted for several changes of clothes. The indications were that this was a long-time project, not something taken on in the last 8 hours when Bella had gone missing. The orange soil on the digging spade gave him pause, however. That could have been used and dirtied any time. Bosch pulled the hand truck out to the tailgate so he could look at it more closely. He assumed that Doc Weiler used it to move stacks of boxes he kept in his home and garage. He then noticed a label taped to the axle between the two rubber wheels. It said, "Property of City of San Fernando Department of Public Works." Doc Weiler had stolen or borrowed the hand truck for his own purposes. Bosch assumed that if he looked closely enough, many of the tools in the truck and garage would be seen to have come from the workbenches in the public works yard. But he wasn't sure how the hand truck fit with what Doc Weiler was doing that night at the tailgate. Bosch felt he had worked the exigent circumstances to the maximum allowed. He backed away from the truck and pulled his phone. He scrolled through his contact list to the letter J, where he kept the contact information of judges that he'd had good enough experiences with to ask for and receive their cell numbers. He first called Judge Robert O'Neill, who had presided over a 4-month murder trial in which Bosch had been lead detective. Bosch checked his watch after sending the call and saw it was not yet 11 p.m., which always seemed to be the witching hour with judges. They got upset when you called them later, even in an emergency. O'Neill answered promptly with no sign of sleep or intoxicants in his voice. This was something to note. Bosch had once had a case where the defense lawyer challenged the validity of a search warrant because it had been signed by a judge at 3 a.m. after Bosch had woken him from sleep. "Judge O'Neill, it's Harry Bosch. I hope I'm not waking you."
"Harry, how are you?"
"No, you didn't wake me. These days I stay up late and sleep even later." Bosch wasn't sure what he meant by the last part. "Are you on vacation, sir? Could you still approve a telephonic affidavit? We've got a missing..." "Let me stop you right there, Harry. You apparently didn't hear the news. I'm off the bench. I pulled the plug 3 months ago." Bosch was stunned and embarrassed. Since his own retirement from the LAPD, he had not kept track of who held sway in the courtrooms in the Foltz building.
"You retired?" he asked.
"I did," O'Neill said. "And last I heard, you did too. Is this some kind of a prank?"
No, sir. No prank. I'm doing some work for the San Fernando Police Department now, and I need to go. We have an emergency situation here, and I'm sorry to have bothered you."
Bosch disconnected before O'Neill could ask anything else and waste Harry's time. He quickly went back to his contact list, deleted O'Neill, and then called Judge John Houghton, who was next in line on the list of judges friendly to Bosch. He was known as Shootin' Houghton among local cops and lawyers because he had a concealed carry permit and once fired a shot into the ceiling of his courtroom to restore order during a brawl between defendants in the Mexican Mafia prosecution. He was subsequently censured by the County Judicial Committee and the California Bar, and was also charged by the city attorney with illegal use of a firearm, a misdemeanor. Despite all of that, he routinely won landslide re-election each term as a law and order judge. He, too, answered with a clear voice.
"Harry Bosch, I thought you retired."
"Retired and hired, Judge. I'm working for San Fernando PD now, part-time on their backlog of cold cases. But I'm calling because we have an all-hands emergency going, a missing officer, and I'm outside a suspect's house and need to conduct a search. We're hoping to find her still alive."
"A female officer?"
"Yes, sir, a detective. We think the suspect in a serial rape case grabbed her about 7 or 8 hours ago. We did a quick run-through of the property under exigent circumstance. Now we would like to go back in for a deep look for the officer and anything relating to the underlying rape case."
"I understand.
This is all moving very quickly, and I don't have time to go back to the station to print up an affidavit. Can I run down the probable cause for you and follow up with the paperwork tomorrow?"
"Go ahead. Give it to me."
The first hurdle jumped. Bosch spent the next 5 minutes going through the steps and the evidence that led them to Dockweiler as a screencutter suspect. He threw in many other bits of information that he could not connect to either the screencutter case or the abduction of Bella Lourdes, but that he knew would help paint the picture for the judge and lead to his approval to search. Things like digging tools in the truck, the warm bag of food for two, the terrible condition of the home. All of it, combined with Dockweiler's pedigree as a former police officer, won the day, and Houghton gave Bosch permission to search Dockweiler's house and vehicle. Bosch thanked the judge profusely and promised to turn in a written search warrant affidavit the next day.
"I'll hold you to that," Houghton said.
Chapter 32. After disconnecting, he went back into the house and signaled down the hallway to Valdez, who was back in the same spot under the archway entrance to the kitchen. The police chief hurried down the hallway to where Bosch waited by the front door. Bosch heard voices from the kitchen, but this time it wasn't Trevino talking. It was Dockweiler. Valdez spoke before Bosch could tell him about the telephonic warrant he had just procured.
"Trevino broke him," he whispered excitedly. "He's going to tell us where she is. Says she's still alive."
The news took Bosch by surprise.
"Trevino broke him?"
Valdez nodded.
"It was deny, 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 then okay, you got me."
Bosch had to see this. He started down the hallway toward the kitchen, questioning whether it was his own vanity and wounded pride that made him doubt Trevino's success, or something else. He entered the kitchen and Dockweiler was still at the table,
hands double-cuffed behind his back into the chair. When he glanced up and saw it was Bosch and not Valdez, a momentary look passed over his face. Bosch wasn't sure if it was disappointment or some other reaction. He had never seen Dockweiler before the events of this night, and had no precursors for facial reads of him. But soon enough he got a translation. Dockweiler pointed at him with his chin. "I don't want him in here," he said. "I'm not talking if he's here." Trevino turned around and saw it was Bosch, not Valdez, who had upset the suspect. "Detective Bosch," he said, "why don't you..." "Why not?" Bosch said over the captain's voice. "Afraid I'll know that you're spinning a line of bullshit?" "Bosch," Trevino barked, "leave the room, now. We are getting this man's full cooperation, and if he wants you out, then you're out." Bosch didn't move. This was ridiculous. "She's only got so much air," Dockweiler said. "If you want to play games, what happens is on you, Bosch." Bosch felt Valdez grab his upper arm from behind. He was about to be pulled out of the room. He looked over at Sisto, who was leaning against the counter behind Trevino. He smirked and shook his head like Bosch had become some sort of pitiful nuisance that had to be put up with. "Harry, let's walk out," Valdez said. Bosch looked at Dockweiler one last time and tried to get a read on him, but his eyes were dead. A psychopath's eyes. Unreadable. In that moment, he knew there was a play here. He just didn't know what it was. Bosch felt a tug on his arm from Valdez, and he finally turned toward the archway. He stepped out of the kitchen and started down the hallway to the front door. Valdez followed him to make sure he didn't double back. "Let's go out," Valdez said. They stepped through the front door and Valdez closed it behind them. "Harry, we have to play it this way," Valdez said. "The guy's talking and he says he'll take us to her. We have no choice." "That's a ploy," Bosch said. "He'll just be looking for a chance to make a move." "We know that. We're not stupid. We're not taking him on a field trip in the middle of the night. If he really wants to cooperate and show us where Bella is, then he can draw us a map. But he's staying in that chair, no question." "Look, Chief, there's something not right here. Things don't add up with what I'm seeing in his truck, in the house, and everything. We need..." "What doesn't add up?" "I don't know yet. If I had been in there and heard what he was saying, or if I was asking the questions, then I'd have a handle on it. But, look, I have to go back in there and watch over this. Just sit tight, and when we get what we need from him, I'll relay it to you. You can lead the charge and go get Bella. I don't need to be a hero. That's not what this is about. I still think it's bullshit. He's not going to do this. You read the screen cutter profile. It's all in there. Guys like this don't ever admit to anything. They have no guilt. So there's nothing to admit to. They're manipulators to the end. I can't keep debating it. Harry, I have to go in. You stay out of the house." Valdez turned and went back in through the front door. Bosch stood there for a long moment, thinking and trying to get a read on the look he had seen on Dockweiler's face. After a few moments, he decided to move around to the back of the house to try to see what was going on in the kitchen. Valdez had instructed him to stay outside the house. He didn't say where outside. Bosch quickly moved down the side and into the backyard. The kitchen was at the opposite corner, and the table where Dockweiler and Trevino sat facing each other was in an eating nook located in the glass sunroom. The blinds were three-quarters open, and the room glowed with interior lights. Bosch knew that the men inside would only see their own reflections in the glass, and not him standing outside. He could hear what was being said in the room because of the open window over the sink, and almost all of it was coming from Dockweiler. One of his hands had now been uncuffed so that he could use a pencil to draw a map on a large piece of paper spread on the table. "They call this section the John Ford 40," he said. "I think he filmed part of one of his John Wayne epics there, and it's mostly used for westerns and horror stuff. The Cabin in the Woods screamers they make all the time and go straight to streaming. There's like 16 different cabins back in there that can be used for filming." "So where is Bella?" Trevino pressed. "She's in this one here," Dockweiler said. He used the pencil to draw something on the map, but his upper torso blocked Bosch's view from behind him. Dockweiler then put the pencil down at the table and did some tracing on the map with his finger. "You go in there, tell whoever's at the gate that you need to get to the Bonnie house. They'll take you up there, and that's where you'll find her. Everything's breakaway in these houses. Walls, windows, floors, you know, for filming.
Your girl's in a camera trench under the flooring. It lifts up in one piece.
This better not be bullshit, Dockweiler, Valdez said.
No bullshit, Dockweiler said.
I can lead you there if you want.
Dockweiler gestured, as if to say, why not give me a chance? And when he did so, his elbow hit the pencil and it rolled off the table, bouncing off his thigh to the floor.
Oops, he said.
He leaned down and reached to the floor to retrieve the pencil, a maneuver made difficult because his left wrist was still handcuffed behind his back to one of the rungs of the chair. Through the window behind Dockweiler, Bosch had a unique vantage point on what happened next. It seemed to unfold before him in slow motion. Dockweiler took a swipe at the fallen pencil on the floor, but couldn't quite reach it because he was bound to the chair in which he sat. However, the momentum of the swing carried his arm up and under the table. He gripped something attached to the underside of the table, then swung his arm out and above it. He was now pointing a semi-automatic pistol directly across the table at Trevino.
Nobody fucking move!
The three men facing Dockweiler froze. Bosch slowly and quietly pulled his weapon from its holster and put a two-handed aim on Dockweiler's back. He knew in a legal sense he was clear to shoot, and it would be a righteous kill, but he didn't have a clean shot, with Trevino sitting on the other side of the target. Dockweiler used the barrel of his gun to point Valdez farther into the kitchen. The police chief complied, holding his hands up in front of his chest. In front of Dockweiler, the kitchen counters created a U where he corralled the three cops. He told Trevino to stand up and back into the U with Valdez and Sisto.
Easy now, Trevino said as he backed up.
I thought we were talking and that we were going to figure this thing out.
You were talking, Dockweiler said. And now it's time to shut the fuck up.
Okay, okay, no problem. Dockweiler then ordered them one at a time to unholster their weapons, put them on the floor and kick them across the floor toward him. Dockweiler rose from the chair and brought his left arm around, the chair dangling by the handcuffs. He brought his hand down on the table and ordered Sisto to come over and remove the cuffs from his wrist. Sisto complied and then moved back into the confines of the kitchen counters. With Dockweiler now standing, Bosch had a bigger target, but he still didn't have a safe shot. He didn't know enough about the science of ballistics to guess how much a shot through glass would deviate from aim. He just knew that if he fired multiple shots, those that followed the first should be clean. Additionally, there was a risk that Dockweiler might be able to squeeze off a shot if the first bullet through the glass did not hit its mark. Bosch looked down to be sure of his footing on the concrete patio and took a step closer to the glass. Dockweiler was less than 8 feet away with a plate of glass of unknown thickness between them. Bosch was resigned to hold off until he had to fire.
Where's Bosch? Dockweiler asked.
He's out front going through your truck, Valdez said.
I want him in here.
I can get him. Valdez made a move toward the archway, which immediately drew Dockweiler's aim.
Don't be stupid, Dockweiler said. Call him and tell him to get in here. Don't tell him why. Just tell him to get in here.
Valdez slowly reached to his belt and pulled off his phone. Bosch realized that his own phone was about to ring and it would give away his position. He was about to reach into his pocket to silence it when he realized that he wanted exactly that to happen. Bosch shifted one step to his right so that he was on an angle that put Dockweiler directly between his aim and Valdez. Trevino and Sisto were in the clear, and Bosch was counting on LAPD training still being ingrained in Valdez and his knowing when the shot would come. He maintained the two-handed grip and waited for the call. His phone buzzed at first, giving him a split-second warning. Then came the chirping sound, a piercing ringtone chosen long ago by his daughter. Bosch had his aim on center mass, Dockweiler's back, but his attention was focused on the back of his head. He saw Dockweiler react. He had heard the phone. He raised his head a few centimeters and then turned it slightly left as he attempted to locate the origin of the sound. Bosch waited another split second for Valdez to react and then opened fire. Bosch put 6 bullets through the window in less than 3 seconds. The sound reverberated off the glass and the roof overhang, creating a tremendous blowback of sound. Glass crashed and the blinds kicked up and splintered as bullets tore through them. Bosch was careful to keep his aim on a horizontal plane. He wanted no shots to angle down toward the floor where he hoped Valdez was. Dockweiler dropped forward onto the table
and then rolled left and fell off onto the floor. Bosch raised his aim and watched while Trevino and Sisto, who were still standing, moved toward the man.
"Hold fire," Trevino yelled. "He's down, he's down!"
The glass in the window frame was gone, and the blinds hung in tatters. The smell of burnt gunpowder seared Bosch's nose. He grabbed the blinds and tore them down so he could enter through the door-sized window. He first checked Valdez, who was sitting on the floor, his legs spread in front of him, his back to the lower cabinets. His phone was still in his hand, but his call to Bosch had now gone to message. He was staring at Dockweiler on the floor 5 feet from him. His eyes came up to Bosch's.
"Everybody okay?" Bosch asked.
Valdez nodded, and Bosch noticed a bullet hole in the drawer 2 feet to the left of his head. Bosch next looked down on Dockweiler. The big man was chesting down on the floor, his face turned to the left. He was not moving, but his eyes were open, and he was breathing, a labored whistling sound to each of his intakes. Bosch saw 3 bullet impacts. One was center left about halfway down his back. One was on his left buttock, and one on his left elbow. Bosch got down on the floor next to the suspect and looked across his torso at Trevino.
"Good shooting," Trevino said.
Bosch nodded. He then leaned further down and looked up under the table. He saw the holster attached to the underside of the tabletop. Trevino followed his eyeline and did the same.
"Son of a bitch," he said.
"A good survivalist is ready for anything," Bosch said. "I think we're going to find weapons hidden all over the place in here." Bosch pulled a set of latex gloves out of his pocket. As he was putting them on, he leaned down close to Dockweiler's face.
"Dockweiler, can you hear me?" he asked. "Can you talk?"
Dockweiler swallowed hard before trying to respond.
"Get me. Hospital.
Bosch nodded. "Yeah, we're going to get to that," he said. "But first we need to know where Bella is. You tell us that, and we'll call in the R.A.
"Harry," Valdez said.
Bosch leaned back on his haunches.
"You guys might want to step out," he said. "I'll handle this."
"Harry," Valdez said, "we can't do it this way."
"You want Bella alive?" Bosch asked.
"You said before you doubted she was alive."
"That was before I found hot food for her in the truck. She's alive, and he's going to tell us where."
Sisto stepped over to the table and grabbed the map that Dockweiler had drawn.
"We have this," he said.
"Yeah, that's a treasure map," Bosch said. "If you think that's where she is, you better run over there and be the hero." Sisto looked over at Valdez, and then down at Trevino, not quite comprehending that Dockweiler had been playing them the whole time, in order to get a hand free to grab his hidden gun. Valdez raised his phone, and clicked off the call to Bosch. He then hit a speed dial button. "We need a rescue ambulance to this address," he said. "Suspect is down, multiple gunshot wounds. We'll need the sheriff's department to roll. Tell them we need an OIS team." Valdez looked at Bosch as he disconnected, the silent message being that they would do this by the book. Bosch leaned down and tried one more time with Dockweiler.
"Where is she, Dockweiler?" he said. "Tell us now or you won't make it to the hospital alive."
"Harry," Valdez said, "get up and go outside." Bosch ignored him. He leaned further down at Dockweiler's ear.
"Where is she?" he demanded.
"Fuck you,"
Dockweiler said between gulps of air.
"I tell you, nothing changes for me. Better you know that you failed her."
He managed to curl his lip back, in what Bosch assumed was a smile. Bosch started to reach a gloved hand toward the bullet wound on his back.
"Bosch!" Valdez yelled. "Outside! Now! That's an order!"
The chief climbed to his feet and moved in to yank Bosch away from Dockweiler if necessary. Harry looked up at him, and then stood. They stared at each other until finally Bosch spoke.
"I know she's here," he said.
Chapter 33 Bosch knew he had little time to stay on the case before the sheriff's department officer-involved shooting team arrived on scene and sequestered him and the other San Fernando officers. While paramedics worked to stabilize Dockweiler and then lift him onto an ambulance gurney, Bosch took a high-powered flashlight out of one of the boxes in the garage and headed down the sloping backyard toward the Haskell Canyon Wash. He was 40 yards from the house when he heard his name called from behind. He turned to find Sisto running to catch up.
"What are you doing?" he said.
"Going to search the wash," Bosch said.
"For Bella?"
Then I'll help. What about Dockweiler? Who's going to the hospital with him? I think the captain, but it doesn't matter. Dockweiler's not going anywhere. I heard the EMTs talking. They said a bullet might have cut his spinal cord. Bosch thought about that for a moment. The idea that Dockweiler might survive and finish his life in a wheelchair invoked no sympathy in him. What Dockweiler had done to his victims, including Bella, though Bosch didn't know yet exactly what Bella had suffered at Dockweiler's hands, disqualified him from ever earning anything like compassion. Okay, but we've got to move quickly, Bosch said. Once the shooting team gets here, I'm out. We all are. So what do you want me to do? Bosch reached into his pocket. He still had the flashlight he had grabbed off the front lawn as backup. He turned it on and tossed it to Sisto. You go one way and I'll go the other. You think she's tied up to a tree or something? Maybe. Who knows? I just hope she's alive. When we get down there, we split up and look. Roger that. The men continued down the slope. The wash was little more than an overgrown ravine that was left undeveloped because of the potential for flooding. Bosch guessed that most days it was a creek, but during storms it could become a river. They passed signs warning of flash flood warning during rainstorms, signs meant to keep kids from playing in the wash. As the slope started to level off, the ground was softer, and Bosch noticed what looked like a track worn into the pathway. It was no more than 6 inches wide and 3 inches deep, and he followed it all the way to the water's edge. Before splitting from Sisto, he crouched down and put his light into the mini-trench. He saw what looked like a tire tread. Bosch raised the beam of his light and followed the track to the shallow waters of the wash. The water was clear, and he could see to the bottom. He saw what looked like gray sand in places, large chunks of gray rock in others. Some of the flat, polished edges were the giveaway. It was concrete that had been formed and hardened and then broken. It was construction debris.
Harry, come on. Are we going to look for her? Sisto asked.
Just hold on a second, Bosch said. Be still. Bosch turned off his light and stayed at the water's edge. He thought about what he had seen and what he knew. The concrete rubble, the guns and supplies, the wheelbarrow and the hand truck stolen from public works, the hot food on the front seat of the truck. He realized what Dockweiler had been up to and what he was doing at the tailgate of his truck earlier that night when the chief's phone interrupted him. Dockweiler's been building something, he said. He was taking wheelbarrows of concrete and dirt down here and dumping it in the wash.
Okay, Sisto said. What does that mean?
It means we're looking in the wrong place, Bosch said. He abruptly stood up and turned his light back on. He turned and looked back up the slope, toward the kitchen lights of Dockweiler's house. I had it wrong, he said. We have to go back.
What?
Sisto asked. I thought we were going to... Bosch was already running back up the slope. Sisto stopped talking and started following him. The climb back up winded Bosch, and he was moving at a modest trot by the time he was passing by the house. Through the windows of the sunroom, he could see men in suits and knew that sheriff's investigators were now on the scene. He didn't know if they were members of the officer-involved shooting team and didn't stop to find out. He saw Chief Valdez with them. He was gesturing and pointing, most likely giving them the initial rundown of what had happened. Bosch continued down the side of the house and into the front yard. There were now two sheriff's patrol cars and one plane wrap parked out front, but everybody was apparently inside. Bosch went straight to the back of Dockweiler's pickup and started pulling out the two-wheeled hand truck. Sisto caught up with him at the back of the truck and helped him lower the heavy cart to the ground.
What are we doing, Harry? He asked.
We have to move those boxes in the garage, Bosch said.
Why? What's in them?
Not what's in them. What's under them? He pushed the cart toward the garage. Dockweiler was about to take this out of his truck and start moving these boxes, he said.
How come? Sisto asked.
Because he had hot food in the truck and wanted to deliver it.
Harry, I'm not following.
That's okay, Sisto. Just start moving boxes. Bosch attacked the first row of boxes with a hand truck, sliding its blade under the bottom box and then tilting the cart and the column of boxes back. He quickly backed out of the garage into the front of the pickup. He placed the column down, yanked the hand truck back, and quickly went back for more. Sisto worked with only his own muscles. He moved two and three boxes at a clip, stacking them out on the driveway near the pickup. In 5 minutes, they had made a large inroad into the stacks, and Bosch came upon a rubber mat that covered the floor and was designed to be used to catch oil from the vehicle parked in the garage. He used the hand truck to move a few more stacks of boxes, then reached down and rolled back the mat. There was a round metal manhole cover flush with a concrete floor. It had the seal of the city of San Fernando embossed on it. Bosch crouched down and put two fingers into what looked like air holes and tried to pull up the heavy plate. He couldn't do it. He looked around for Sisto. "Help me with this," he said. "Hold on, Harry," Sisto said. He disappeared from Bosch's view and was gone for a few seconds. When he came back, he had a long iron bar bent into a handle on one end and a hook on the other. "How the hell did you find that?" Bosch asked as he got out of the way. "I saw it on the workbench and wondered what it was for," Sisto said. "Then I figured it out. I'd seen the guys from Public Works using them in the street." He fit the hook into one of the holes in the iron plate and started pulling it up. "That's probably where he stole it from," Bosch said. "You need help?" "I got it," Sisto said. He hoisted the manhole out, and it clattered onto the concrete floor. Bosch leaned over the hole and looked down. The overhead light in the garage revealed a ladder leading into darkness. Bosch went over to the stack of boxes where he had seen the light sticks earlier. He yanked open the box and took out several. Behind him he heard Sisto yell into the hole he had opened. "Bella?" There was no response. Bosch returned and started opening the sticks, snapping them on, and dropping them down the hole. He then started down the ladder. The descent was no more than 10 feet, but there was no last rung on the ladder, and he almost fell as he placed his foot where the rung should have been. He lowered himself the rest of the way and then reached into his back pocket for the flashlight. He turned it on and played it against the concrete walls of a chamber that was still clearly under construction. There were iron supports and plywood molds for concrete. Plastic sheeting hung from makeshift scaffolding. There was air, but not enough of it. Bosch found himself on the verge of hyperventilating as he gulped for oxygen. He guessed that an air cleaning and filtration system was not in place or not operating. The only fresh air entering the chamber was from the opening above. He realized that this was Dockweiler's dream. He had been building an underground bunker where he would be able to retreat and hide when the big quake hit, or the bomb was dropped, or the terrorists came. "Anything?" Sisto called down. "Still looking," Bosch said. "I'm coming down. Just watch that last rung. It isn't there." Bosch started making his way around the construction debris and down the length of the chamber. When he pushed through a plastic curtain, he had to step up to a section that was nearly complete, its walls smooth and floor level and carpeted in black rubber matting. He swept his flashlight across all surfaces and saw nothing. Bella was not here. Bosch turned in a complete circle. He had been wrong. Sisto pushed through the plastic curtain. "She's not here?" "No." "Shit. We've got to look in the house. Maybe he was telling the truth about the movie ranch." Bosch pushed back through the plastic and made the step down into the first chamber. When he got to the ladder, he realized that there wasn't a missing rung. The ladder simply extended down to the level the floor would be at when the chamber was completed. He turned around and almost banged into Sisto. He pushed past him, and then again through the plastic curtain to the finished room. He trained his light over the floor, looking for a seam. "I thought we were going back up," Sisto said. "Help me," Bosch said. "I think she's here. Pull up this matting." They each went to a side of the room and started pulling the rubber matting back. It was one piece cut to fit the space. As it was rolled back, Bosch could see wooden planking beneath. He started looking for a hinge or a seam, or some indication of a hidden compartment, but he saw nothing. Bosch banged his fist down on the wood and determined there was a definite hollow below it. Sisto started pounding the floor as well. "Bella? Bella?" Still no response. Bosch scuttled across the floor to the plastic curtain, grabbed it, and jerked it down, bringing a metal frame crashing down with it. "Watch it," Sisto yelled. One arm of the frame hit Bosch on the shoulder, but he wasn't fazed. He was flying on adrenaline. He dropped down to the front chamber again and put the light on the facing of the 8-inch step riser. He saw a seam running completely around the facing that curved with the contour of the concrete floor,
On his knees, he moved in and tried to open it, but he couldn't figure it out. "Help me get this open," he called to Sisto. The young detective got down next to Bosch and tried to get his fingernails into the seam. He could not get a grip. "Look out," Bosch said. He grabbed a piece of the curtain's fallen frame and drove its edge into the seam. Once it was jammed in tightly, he levered the frame upward, and the seam opened an inch. Sisto put his fingers in and pulled the board free. Bosch dropped the frame with a metal clatter and put his light into the shallow space under the second room's floor. He saw bare feet, heels down on a blanket and tied together. The space under the floor was recessed and deeper than the dimensions of the floor and step indicated from the outside. "She's here!" He reached in and gripped either side of the blanket and pulled it out. Bella Lourdes came sliding out of the shallow black space on a blanket spread over a plywood pallet. She barely cleared the opening created by the steps riser. She was bound and gagged and bloodied. Her clothes were gone, and she was either dead or unconscious. "Bella!" Sisto yelled. "Call for another RA," Bosch ordered. "They'll need a portable stretcher to get her through the manhole." As Sisto pulled his phone, Bosch turned back to Bella's side. He bent down and put his ear to her mouth. He felt the faint wind of breath. She was alive. "I got no signal," Sisto said in frustration. "Go up," Bosch yelled back. "Go back up." Sisto ran to the ladder and started climbing. Bosch pulled his jacket off and put it over Bella's body. He pulled the pallet closer to the ladder and the air from the manhole. Bella started to regain consciousness as she got more air. Her eyes opened, and they were startled, confused. She started shaking. "Bella," Bosch said. "It's me, Harry. You're safe, and we're going to get you out of here." Chapter 34 Bosch spent the entire night with the sheriff's investigators, first talking them through the steps that led to the arrival of the San Fernando officers at Dockweiler's home, and then walking them through a play-by-play accounting of the moves that led to the shooting. Bosch had just been through the process the year before after a shooting in West Hollywood. He knew what to expect, and knew it was routine, and yet he could not take it as such. He knew he needed to carefully make the case that his decision to fire through the window at Dockweiler's back was warranted and unavoidable. Essentially, Dockweiler's pointing a weapon at three officers in the kitchen made the use of deadly force acceptable. The investigative report would take weeks to put together, as investigators waited on ballistic and forensic reports and collated it all with the interviews of the officers involved and schematic drawings at the shooting scene. It would then be presented to the district attorney's police shooting unit for another review, which would also take several weeks. A final declaration of the shooting as justified and within the scope of police authority would then be issued. Bosch wasn't worried about his actions, and he also knew that Bella Lourdes would be a significant factor in the investigation. The fact that she was rescued from Dockweiler's underground shelter would blow away any possible media backlash that could put pressure on the DA's office. It would be hard to question the tactics resulting in the shooting of a man who had abducted a police officer, sexually assaulted her, and then held her in an underground chamber with the obvious intention of keeping her alive, the food he had brought home, for repeated assaults before eventually killing her. It was dawn by the time the investigators said they were finished with Bosch. They told him to go home and get some rest, and that they might have further questions over the next couple of days before they moved into the collating and writing phase of the investigation. Bosch said he would be available. Bosch had learned during the course of his interview that Lourdes had been transported to the trauma center at Holy Cross. On his way home, he stopped by the hospital to see if he could get an update on her condition. He found Valdez in the waiting room of the trauma center, and he could tell he had been there all night, since being released by the sheriff's investigators. He was sitting on a couch next to a woman Bosch recognized was Bella's partner from the photos in our cubicle. "You finished with the sheriff's investigators?" Valdez said. "For now," Bosch said. "They sent me home." "How is Bella?" "She's sleeping. Taryn here has been allowed to go back and see her a couple of times." Bosch introduced himself to Taryn, and she thanked him for his part in the rescue. Bosch just nodded, feeling more guilty for his part in sending Lourdes to Dockweiler than good about rescuing her from him. Bosch looked at Valdez and made a slight head nod toward the hallway. He wanted to talk, but not with